Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 308 of the Fun with Cars Formula One and Other Motorsports Podcast, or episode 42 of 2021. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man who now definitely likes Tuesdays way more than he likes tacos, Christopher Roche. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Robin.
It is Monday afternoon, November 8th, and Chris and I are going to talk about the Mexican Grand Prix. And I have a fantastic interview with the winningest American at the 24 Hours of Le Mans, Johnny O'Connell. Yes, he and I spoke a little while ago, and I'm very excited to share it. But first, Chris, I imagine that you might have a little bit of Formula One news to discuss.
There are a couple of tidbits. So we never talked about the interesting poll that was conducted of F1 fans on their favorite drivers and teams. Do you want to talk about that?
Desperately.
Who do you think was the top three drivers?
Fan favorites?
Fan favorites.
Okay, well, let's do this. Let's go over the actual top three and then our own personal top three. Does that sound good to you?
Sounds good to me.
All right. Actual top three, I'm going to guess, Max Verstappen, Lando Norris, and, I don't know. It seems like Lewis Hamilton's kind of become an anti-hero, so I have a hard time calling him, but I'll just say him because there's enough Brits around still.
Well, you knocked it out of the park. Maybe you read the same article as I did. Yes, it was Max, Norris, Hamilton in that order, with Max getting 14.4% of the votes, Norris 13.7% and Hamilton on 12.5%. And for the record, we had Daniel Ricciardo in fourth, Vettel fifth, Leclerc sixth, Alonso seventh, Raikkonen still up there at eighth, and George Russell ninth.
Okay. All right. Now, how about your personal favorite three, Chris?
Of the current grid?
Current grid.
Well, obviously, I would be doing a disservice not to support my favorite seven-time world champion, Lewis Hamilton, would be number one.
As opposed to your least favorite seven-time world champion that's also a current Formula One driver?
Well, actually, the other seven-time world champion is actually one of my least favorite drivers. It gets tricky from there. I think I'd have to say, you know, just on, you know, their overall contribution to the sport, I probably have to put Alonso in second because I think he is an incredible driver and has just been, you know, a constant source of amusement in his time at Formula One. And then probably I would say third, maybe tricky. I should have thought about this before we talked about it, shouldn't I? I would probably have to say one of... it would be hard to split Norris and Russell for me.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, that's fair. Those two occupy the same bucket of young Brits, rising stars, et cetera, don't they?
They do, indeed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, for me, I would also choose Hamilton. He is, he's just kind of developed into this great character in the sport. Obviously, he's not perfect, but who is? And I think just... the amount of attention and the vast majority of it positive that he brings to the sport around the world and his driving technique and his attitude about it, all those things, I have to give him the nod as well. From there, you and I depart. I think that my number two is Daniel Ricciardo. He's just endless entertainment, always has a big smile on his face. Even when he doesn't, like, even when he's frowning, he somehow is smiling. It's kind of this incredible thing. He's been on Ellen. He's owns a house in Los Angeles. He loves America. And I think he brings a lot of fun. He brought us the shoey, among many other great things. He loves NASCAR. So, I mean, what can't you love about him? And then for number three, boy... yeah, Kimi Raikkonen's fallen off. He would have been on my list for a long time.
Wow, I would have bet a lot of money that Kimi was your number three, so I'm shocked. This is big news, everybody.
Well, he's obviously on my mind, as was Alonso.
Kimi had a good Mexican Grand Prix as well, so I figured he was back in favor. No.
I still adore him to the end, and the fact that he named his son after me, I'm honored. But no, I think my number three is Sebastian Vettel. I think he's got there's something unique about him that I really appreciate, and I love how like stereotypically German and yet not at all stereotypically German, like you know, as all people are, they're not the stereotypes of their own nation, and yet the way he follows some of them and then goes completely against the grain of the others, the way that he's so effortlessly international. And, you know, I really took a liking to the role he played in Mick Schumacher driving his dad's Jordan. Do you remember that a few Grand Prix ago? That really stuck to me how Vettel played a supportive role in that.
I agree with you. He's a great character, and long may he stay within the sport, him and Alonso. I think they add a lot of richness and intelligence to the sport, actually. So,
yeah, and certainly agree with your points about Alonso. Certainly, absolutely. He's up there for me as well. Any other news? That was one tidbit. Are there any others?
Well, favorite team?
Oh, well.
This was more of a surprise, actually.
Okay.
Because I assumed everyone would go for Max, because obviously he's the hot driver at the moment, and the anti-Hamilton sort of groundswell. That was not surprising, but the favorite team was a surprise to me.
Okay. Well, why don't you just name them off, but let's do our three personal favorites again.
So McLaren got almost a third of the votes. Clear winners. And then
That was my guess. America! Zach Brown! Oh, yeah.
Okay. how long's Woking been in America, Robin?
We adopted Woking in 2017, I think it was.
I do believe Bruce McLaren was from New Zealand as well. I think we call it an international team, shall we, and just leave it there. So Red Bull was second, at Ferrari third. Now, I would have bet my house that Ferrari would be the favourite team. So that's quite a surprise that they're only third. Mercedes, the dominant team for the past 7 years, came in fourth. And then Alpine fifth. So
Alpine? Huh.
Alpine, no, yes, snuck in there.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a surprise for me. Okay, your personal favourite, sir?
Williams, obviously. I talk a lot about Williams, even though they've been dreadful the last few seasons.
Well, yeah, because they're Williams. No, 100%.
And I will say, I do really like McLaren. I'm very happy to see them back. And in third place, it would be a toss-up between Red Bull and Mercedes. Honestly, I have a huge admiration for what both teams have achieved in the last decade.
Well, this is not the most respect you have for the team, because if it were, Mercedes and Red Bull I would 100% agree with you. But just in terms of, like, you want to support them, you want to see them do well, that to me shuffles the deck just a little bit. So my number one, I think we're going to be pretty close, because Williams, of course, what Frank put together with that team, and what he and Patrick Head did in the 80s and 90s, and the characters like Nigel Mansell, and what happened with, just the entire history. I can't even go over it all. And of course, you know, my favorite driver, Jacques Villeneuve, was part of that team. So Williams is the clear number one. Ferrari, I don't know. I don't know where they land. But so Williams is number one. I do think that I'm going to put McLaren at number two.
Wow.
And then for my third favorite team, I have to say Mercedes, because I just like the way they operate, and I really love how I absolutely love their anxiety. I love how absolutely petrified they are that they're not going to be as competitive next year as they were before, and that's what brought them to this, like, not sitting on their laurels, not appreciating just one year of dominance after another. Now Red Bull has finally caught up to them, but yeah, I think Mercedes is my third favorite. So there it is. That is a fun little bit. Okay, any more bits of TID?
Two more small pieces of news. China's back on the calendar from 23 until 25. They signed a yes. deal until 2025. So a
little bit of that, update. Yeah. And then so they're taking a year off, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, COVID worries for next year. But we had speculated that it would be a loss if Formula One didn't go to China. And I guess the F1 bigwigs agreed, so they put them back on the calendar. So
good for them, yes.
The other thing that I was interested about was for fans of sort of racing movies and Formula One racing movies in particular, there is a movie being made of the 1982 season, in particular the battle between Gilles Villeneuve and Didier Pironi. And historians of the sport will know, yeah, this was a very sad situation where Pironi essentially stole the win off Villeneuve at San Marino. And Gilles was so mad when they went to Zolder and was still driving with a rage that ultimately cost his life, very sadly. So the families of the drivers are going to be talking about that incident or that season and other drivers as well. So that should, you know, if
this is a documentary then.
No, I think it's going to be more like a Rush type movie. So if you think about
okay. So it's inspired by a true story, but they're going to take liberties with details, perhaps.
I guess it could be. That is a good question. Actually, I don't know for sure. It could be more like the Senna movie, less like the Rush. I'm not certain. But yeah, given that they've got these people weighing in, if they're going to be interviewed, then you would think it would be more like the Senna movie. Rush brought obviously the battle between Niki Lauda and James Hunt to a lot of people who hadn't ever gone back that far in F1 history. And I think, you know, showed the sport in a new light to the newer fans. And hopefully this will too. And of course, Gilles, we've talked about Gilles in the past, you know, one of the most charismatic drivers to ever be in F1. Some people's favorite drivers of all time. Used to drive the wheels off his Ferrari. It sounds like it'll be a good watch, whatever it turns into.
Right. Yeah, well, no, it's certainly fascinating. And it's nice that more movies are showing us different periods of Formula One. You know, there was a movie, and of course I'm going to completely blank on the name, but it was Ferrari in the late 50s and the tragedy that begot those drivers in that era. And I believe that included Mike Hawthorn. And I hope, oh boy, I'm just not feeling at all confident. Am I remembering his name correctly? It was Hawthorn. That part's
yeah, Hawthorn was the first British world champion, actually.
There you go. And 58, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Let's just say I'm correct because... because I don't know, Wikipedia seems really hard for me right now. and then Rush absolutely in the 70s, so it's cool to get the 80s. I wonder what the 90s drama would be. I suppose
we've had that with Senna, and I mean the Senna movie covers
Senna battle, of course. Of course, Senna is the big one. So the 90s are covered. So I guess would that be, because the late 90s, it'd be cool to do Mika Hakkinen and Schumacher, but that's all
the Schumacher documentary covers that period as well. So you could argue that really what we're missing is probably the 60s and the 80s. So this one will cover the 80s. And I mean, the 60s, my goodness, there's so many great drivers from that period with Jim Clark and Lotus and... And then you
there's a
like
new
Brabham.
Phil Hill book out about, from his son about 61. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I know you're absolutely right. Cause you know, Jim Clark, for sure. In the end of the '60s with Stewart and all the things in between. Yeah, absolutely. That would be a great, great era to cover. And so many new technologies were born in the '60s as well.
Oh, that's right. Wings, the stress monocoque rear engines. I mean, all sorts of fascinating developments in that time. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. But we are definitely digressing, and I'm going to digress just one more little bit because I have some IndyCar news. The Detroit Grand Prix is moving back to downtown Detroit as of 2023. So since the early 90s, when it was held at Belle Isle, which is a small island about 3 miles long, and it's about 3 miles outside of downtown Detroit. I personally think it's a great venue for the race, but there's been a combination of things. The Detroit City Council approved it for 2023, so that's the official reasons why it's coming back. But more and more people were getting less and less patient about the Grand Prix taking up their beloved Belle Isle for the summer months and the spring months leading into the summer. What those less and less patient people didn't realize is that Belle Isle was becoming such a nice place to spend time again because of the money that the Detroit Grand Prix brought to the island. But I will digress yet again, and I have a soapbox right next to me that I do not need to stand on right now. The point is, as of 2023, the Detroit Grand Prix will be back in downtown Detroit as it was when Formula One ran it in the late 80s. So it'll be very interesting to see what this new era of downtown racing brings for IndyCar. And here's a fun fact, it will not be held in a parking lot. So that's also a positive, I think.
Oh, that's huge. So are they going to try and retrace some of the original Formula One Grand Prix track? Or because with all the developments down by the Rennsteig, I don't think that's possible, is it? Because it used to run...
It's different layout, I think, but I don't know enough the history to say anything more than a guess.
Yeah, that's a really interesting development. I think that's actually quite cool. I was never the biggest fan, maybe we're going to disagree on this one, of the Belle Isle track, I have to say. I mean, it was very hard to see more than one corner as a spectator. It was a pain to get on and off the island.
There was an obvious and major bottleneck being that there was one bridge to get to and from the island. Yeah, for sure.
But I know they spent an awful lot of money, putting in the basic infrastructure to host the race well there. I mean, all of the Parc Fermé and paddock area was paved over to give them suitable transporter parking. So I've actually, they do autocrossing there these days because it's such a large expanse of tarmac. So that's interesting. I guess we'll get some better roads downtown now. That's good news.
Well, TBD on that.
Maybe. Well, potholes and IndyCars tend to not mix too well, I would think.
Exactly. So, anyway, we do have a race to get to. It was the Mexican Grand Prix. It was a very, very fascinating weekend. Lots of build-up to it. Of course, Sergio Perez was being talked about quite a lot. But I'm going to jump right to the end of Saturday, and then we can go back a bit and you can fill in some gaps. It was a Mercedes 1-2. Not what anybody expected.
It was a shocking qualifying result, really. Absolutely stunning. And Red Bull and their junior team really made a hash of Q3. I mean, a real mess of it. I mean, missing an open goal type mess.
I mean, a literal mess in a lot of ways. I mean, it was Tsunoda?
Tsunoda
that went off, and that distracted Perez, and he went off as well, and it turned into this whole thing. And that, I don't know if that slowed Verstappen down, but it distracted him or something. Next thing we know, Bottas is on pole, and Hamilton's P2, 10th behind.
Yeah, I mean, it was really odd because it looked like from free practice one all the way through to the start of qualifying, Red Bull had their expected advantage. And even in Q1, Mercedes seemed to be struggling for pace on the soft compound tyres. And then all of a sudden, both Max and Sergio couldn't quite get the tyres to work properly in Q3. And their first runs, with no Tsunoda issues, weren't that good. And their second Q3 runs, Max was up on his previous time, but still not quicker than either of the Mercedes. So even if he'd managed to have a clean lap, it's debatable whether or not he would have actually got pole position. But certainly one of the things that was going on was the attempts to draft. So the teams were going out two by two, trying to give the following car a little bit of an advantage down the straight. And unfortunately, what that meant was that if anyone made a mistake, obviously it would then have a knock-on effect to the driver behind. So more of a hindrance than a benefit. And that's exactly what happened. I don't even know why Tsunoda was out at that point, because Tsunoda had an engine penalty. So you would have thought they'd have just kept him off the track and let the guys who were actually vying for pole position have... have the track position, but whatever, he was out there, and yeah, he tripped up Perez, and then Max was saying that he could see tire dust, was expecting a yellow flag, had to lift, and then, you know, his lap had gone pretty much.
Yeah, it was fascinating how all that, and even Q1 and Q2, things more or less seemed to be going as everyone expected. It was not until Q3 that we got these surprise runs. I mean, Mercedes pulled, I think, 7-8 tenths of a second out of their times between Q2 and Q3. I was properly shocked. We had what seemed like, just as you said, Red Bull shot themselves in the foot a bit, but then also Mercedes brought their level up right at the end, and that couldn't have just been sandbagging. That had to be something that they found at the end.
Well, there was some discussion about Mercedes having made some changes to the design of the power unit to address its weakness, historical weakness at the high altitude of Mexico City. But yeah, I mean, it looked like they just kept some of the pace hidden in their back pocket and only used it when they really needed to. But you have to say it was a bit of a miss by Hamilton not to put it on pole. I think, you know, in that situation, when all of a sudden you've got an opportunity to be quickest, to be outpaced by a teammate was not ideal. Whether things would have changed on Sunday if he had been on pole position, we'll never know. But you know, these are the things he's got to be nailing when he gets a chance. So every time Red Bull, you know, give him a half an opportunity, he's got to be taking them. And in this instance, he, you know, Bottas was quicker, fair and square.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely good point to make. Also, Pierre Gasly, he ended up qualifying fifth. Ferrari was strong, qualifying sixth with Carlos Sainz, Daniel Ricciardo seventh, Charles Leclerc eighth. Sonoda did get to Q3. He was ninth. This is obviously before his engine penalty. And Lando, again, you know, kind of only so-so compared to what the kind of performances he's been doing earlier this year to finish, to qualify 10th.
Well, he didn't even set a representative Q3 time, did he? So he... He also had a penalty.
Yeah, no, you're right. His Q2 time was a 17.4. His Q3 time was a 36.8.
Yeah, he basically
pretty sure I could have done a 36.8, Chris, if you'd given me the chance.
Yeah, he did. I think one of his laps he made a mistake, and the other lap he spent most of his time towing Daniel Ricciardo around. So yeah, we don't quite know where he was. It was very close between Daniel Ricciardo, Carlos, and Charles, though. Which suggested a really interesting Sunday race between the two constructors, but that didn't transpire, as we'll talk about in a minute. Yeah. But yeah, there were no fewer than four drivers with engine penalties. So Tsunoda, Norris, Russell and Ocon all taking penalties. And then, but they all started ahead of Lance Stroll, who had a fairly sizable shunt in Q1 at the last corner coming onto the start-finish straight.
It did not seem that big to me. I mean, I know that the G impact was relatively high, but, you know, it was a slow deceleration ultimately, and it just threw a lot of parts around. It never seemed that dramatic to me, having watched it. Am I just ignorant of what occurred?
No, I think your assessment's right. I mean, it did sort of put paid to his attempts to qualify well, though, didn't it?
yes. It definitely hurt that process. And you know, maybe he was just trying to. Maybe his mechanics were complaining of being bored, and he wanted to help them out. I don't know, but
yeah.
That brought a delay to qualifying. But was there anything else about qualifying that we should discuss before we get to the race?
Well, I guess. You know, there was a few interesting drivers that did pretty well. I mean, Kimi Raikkonen qualifying 12th, which then subsequently became 10th with the penalties, was a pretty good effort. And I thought the Alpines were just lamentable. I mean, Alonso down in 16th and Ocon in 15th. Alpine's performance seems to have just, certainly on Saturdays, just vaporized. So that's a bit worrying for that team. But yeah, I mean, Alfa Romeo... And Sauber, you know, of course, you've been, you interviewed one of their engineers last week, I mean, or last podcast. You know, they're making quiet progress, actually, and they're now getting back into the midfield where they used to occupy, you know, last season. So interesting to see their progress.
Absolutely. And it was nice to see Kimi have a car that seems to be more competitive for his last few Grand Prix. So I'm happy for that part. So Mercedes started 1-2. Of course, we get to Sunday. We get to the start of the race. That did not last long. It's a long straightaway going into turn one at the Mexican Grand Prix. You know, 1.2 kilometers is the full length of that straight. But it was clear that Mercedes had perfectly respectable launches, both Bottas and Hamilton. Red Bull were right there. They were right on top of them. And Red Bull got a healthy draft because how could you not? But then just Max was noticeably later on the brakes than anybody else. So what did you make of turn one, lap one? And then obviously we'll get into the calamity that happened behind them.
Yeah, I mean, there are those of us who might have thought that Bottas losing his seat was a big shame after Saturday's events. But Sunday demonstrated why he probably should lose his seat. I mean, it looked like a guy who had a pole position for the first time, didn't it? You know, he didn't. His start wasn't brilliant. I mean, Hamilton got away better than him. But he then just decided to just stick to the middle of the track. You know, he wasn't going to go to the outside line, wasn't going to go to the inside line, wasn't really going to do much. He was just going to sit in the middle. I mean, they must have talked about strategy to try and keep Max behind them going into turn one. They had a huge opportunity for Mercedes, right? I'm sure they realised that Red Bull would still be faster on race pace. So their whole race hinged on trying to keep Max behind them at turn one. And they utterly failed to do that because Bottas just needed to move a little bit further outside. You know, he obviously needed to give Hamilton room on the inside, but he needed to move, you know, at least another half car's width to the outside to stop Max just charging down the outside on the racing line and to take the normal line through the corner. I mean, it was absurd. I mean, it was a great piece of opportunism by Max Verstappen. I give him full credit. You know, he went for it, he nailed it, and that made his afternoon a whole lot easier. And he went on and just disappeared, right? Absolutely superlative effort from Max and the Red Bull team. But you don't need to make his life easier, do you? You should be, I mean, if we, they the Sky team did a nice job of reminding us what happened in previous Mexican Grand Prix. And when the Ferraris had locked out the front row, you had Sebastian Vettel basically trying to put Lewis into the wall or force him right out onto the grass on the outside line. And then that gave Charles the momentum he needed to hold on to the lead. And Vettel then dived back to the inside. And so you had a Ferrari 1-2 coming out of turn one after starting on the front row. So they managed to figure out how to do it. But the Mercedes guys, well, and particularly Valtteri, just looked, you know, out of their depth, just didn't seem to know what to do.
How much of that do you think was Bottas? It's hard to say because there is part of me thinking that Valtteri was thinking, well, this isn't my team really anymore. I'm thinking about my future, so I'm not going to be here just to support Hamilton. I'm on pole and I want to just run my own race. Like, obviously, he lost the position for himself, and obviously, he wasn't expecting to get tagged in the back. That particular part of this whole thing wasn't his fault, but do you think part of what played into what happened was Bottas being a little bit more selfish and actively not trying to support Hamilton?
I mean, that's an interesting hypothesis. I think, clearly, he didn't want to impede Hamilton and his run down to the inside, and maybe he also didn't want to, you know, insert himself too much in the championship battle by blocking Verstappen. But to me, you know, he's always been a team player, and I'm sure, although I'm sure he'd like to get another win or two before he leaves Mercedes, I think he is trying to help Mercedes get, you know, both championships ideally, or at least the constructors championship. And so, you know, I think he just was a bit slow to react, and he didn't do anything decisive with the car at all. You know, even if you're trying to just, you know, okay, ignore the bigger picture, you just try and get the best result for yourself, you're going to be more aggressive going into turn one, you know, go further outside, be later on the brakes. And he didn't either. It was a very odd, aimless move, compounded of course by what happened, you know, between one and two, which then ruined his afternoon. I mean, given what happened, he'd have been better off sacrificing himself and hobbling Verstappen, right? You know, yeah. I mean, yeah, yeah, yeah. And nobody wants to see that. I don't want to see one of the drivers win the championship because their teammate has taken them out. That wouldn't be satisfactory at all. But, you know, given that he finished dead, came out of that sequence of turns almost dead last, he'd be better off being more aggressive and trying to defend more robustly. But yeah, it was a weak effort, I think, by Bottas.
Yeah, ultimately, it made Max look like a rock star, but perhaps he could have had a more robust defense than that. And there had to be a decent amount of planning and discussions from the strategist, because it's so clear that the people behind you are going to have an opportunity to get a draft and make a run. You have to have had some forethought about those things. This isn't a hindsight's 2020 type of situations. The foresight's also pretty clear this time. So, yeah. It's not a huge surprise that what happened. So I agree with you.
If roles were reversed and if we'd had the grid that we were expecting, if Max had been on pole with Sergio second, do you think they wouldn't have been more robust? Don't you think Sergio would have certainly defended Max more robustly than Valtteri did? I think so. I mean, I think we
would have been having discussions about whether that was what those moves were legal or not, because they would have been so much more aggressive. I think that would have been the discussion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, Mercedes missed a massive opportunity there, I think, is the way to look at it. They had a real chance to at least come out of turn one with one car leading. And then even, you know, Wolff has already said that they probably still wouldn't have won the race given Red Bull's performance. But, you know, you give yourself a bit better chance, don't you? But with Hamilton being sandwiched between Verstappen and Perez, he was always on the back foot, and his race turned into one of damage limitation and trying to hold on to second. I mean, he did well to finish second, quite frankly. Perez gave it a real good shot to make it a Red Bull 1-2 in the race. So, and I mean, as you alluded to, we then had the coming together of Daniel Ricciardo and Valtteri Bottas on the exit of turn one, which, you know, cost them. Both had paid a heavy price for that, ruining both their races. So, yeah, it was a real mess.
And then later on the lap, we saw Yuki Tsunoda out. We saw Mick Schumacher out, which means that we, as a result, saw Nikita Mazepin finish ahead of Mick Schumacher. Congrats to him. But it was a shame. It was a shame to see their race end so early. But it put a different group of folks right at the front of the grid. And for a little while, Nikita Mazepin was in 11th. And that made things a little bit more interesting. And we also had Pierre Gasly right there at the top. You know, he was in the top five for most of the entire race. And then it gave us a really interesting set of strategy circumstances to look at, because Daniel Ricciardo and Bottas both pitted super early, and there were talks for a little while of them maybe trying to run the hard tire effectively the entire Grand Prix, because they switched compounds on lap one, lap two, whichever it was.
Yeah, it was a bit of a shame that it was just a one-stop race for the majority of runners that didn't have any incidents. Valtteri managed to rack up four stops, some of which were quite slow. But everyone else managed to just go from the medium to the hard compound tire.
Valtteri just likes it there. He's built a relationship with those guys, and he wants to spend time with them, hang out.
I guess so. I mean, the pace was of the Red Bulls was extraordinary, though. I think Max had about a 9-second lead by the time Hamilton decided to stop at the end of lap 29. And even though the undercut was still reasonably effective for Lewis and the Mercedes was running well on the hard compound tyre, when Max stopped three, four laps later, he still had a 7.5-second lead. So, you know, we always thought this was going to be a Red Bull track. It's been a Red Bull track in the past when Mercedes have been dominant. So it wasn't that surprising. Just the qualifying result was the surprise of the weekend. What did you think about Perez's inability to put on a meaningful passing attempt on Lewis? He had 10 laps with fresher tyres at the end of the Grand Prix. And although he got DRS multiple times and he got well within a second, I didn't really see any meaningful attempt to pass him, did you?
Well, I thought Perez's attempts were no less meaningless than Bottas's attempts on Daniel Ricciardo, which was, you know, like 40 laps compared to 10 laps that you were discussing. But I think that that is an excellent opportunity to bring up a pretty unique circumstance, which is that these guys were 2 kilometers darn near above sea level for the Mexican Grand Prix. It's a mile and a half, basically, 7,500 feet above sea level. And so there is, I think they were saying a 22% reduction in aero efficiency. And you could see that in what they had. There was more concern about keeping the brakes cool, keeping, obviously, the engine cool and those types of things. But also in terms when the little graphic would show up on the bar, the head protecting bar above the drivers, there were a lot of the corners where the Formula One cars were maintaining less than 2G at the apex of the corner. Now, we typically, especially when we get to the medium and high speed stuff, we see 3-4G being pulled by Formula One cars. And here we are seeing consistently less than 2G. The point I'm getting at is, because these cars are so aero-dependent and because there was so much less air to work with, the effectiveness of the air makes it harder to pass.
Yeah, you're right. And the DRS has less effect in the thin air as well. No, those are all good points. But other people, I don't know. I mean, Lewis reckoned that the Red Bull was about a half a second quicker than the Mercedes. I mean, I don't know if that's entirely accurate, but Sergio had, I was surprised. I really thought when Sergio got within a second, when he got within the DRS range, that he would pass Lewis. And I was surprised that he never even made a move. And I mean, on one hand, that's, you know, good driving by Lewis Hamilton, not to make any mistakes, not to give him an opportunity, not to make it easy for him. But on the other hand, it just, If that had been Max, I think he would have probably got the job done somewhere, don't you?
I agree. Had it been Max, or perhaps maybe Fernando Alonso, someone like that, agree. But also, to be fair, there were a couple of 3 laps where Sergio Perez was really putting the pressure on, but then Hamilton, because Hamilton was struggling to get close enough to Lando Norris for Norris to get blue flags to force Norris to get out of Hamilton's way,
yeah,
and carry on. Hamilton was saying that the turbulence from the McLaren was really hurting his performance. And that proved out once he did finally get close enough to Norris for Norris to see blue flags. Norris got out of the way. Sergio was able to carry on right behind Hamilton as well. Norris got out of the way for both of them at the same time. But once Hamilton had cleaner air, he was able to more easily maintain a gap and often keep it more than a second to be out of DRS range. So it was this bizarre set of circumstances where thinner air means it's less effective aero, means it's harder to make a pass. But at the same time, they were still so aero-sensitive that the turbulence from the car ahead was giving Hamilton noticeable trouble that he could feel, and he couldn't lap the car as quickly. So the Mexican Grand Prix is going to be a race to pay very close attention to next year with the new regulation cars that are theoretically at least way less aerosensitive. And will the Mexican Grand Prix be a more exciting race in terms of on-track passing because this is a thin aero example? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do. I think, I mean, my problem with the Mexican Grand Prix is that I can remember when it was run back in the days of Nigel Mansell in the 90s, when they used to have a really amazing last corner, the Peraltada, which was a real, you know, man's corner, full, you know, hard, like 180 degree left, right-hander. And, you know, you would shoot out onto the straight carrying an awful lot of speed. And we had some great racing at the Mexican Grand Prix back in those days, and the air was still thin back in the 90s. Now, and,
yes,
you know, and now
it wasn't so long ago that the air was thicker. That's true.
Now we have this. I mean, I like what they. I know there was some limitations on the track, and they had to improve safety, and the fact that they've used the baseball seating is very smart. But ultimately, that sequence through the stadium section, you know, it's really just it's Monaco-esque, isn't it? You're not going to have anything really going on there, and it's now ruined the amount of speed you can carry onto the straight. So it seems like that was detrimental to the raceability of the track, and they need to do something to improve it, given what you're saying about the aero inefficiency at altitude. But I mean, don't get me wrong, I thought Perez had a strong weekend. I think he, you know, first Mexican to lead laps at his own home Grand Prix, very cool achievement. He's putting in the sort of performances that Red Bull would have hoped when they promoted him to the seat this year, at the sharp end of the grid.
One podium after another these last few races. I mean, he's really getting there where he can deliver consistently, it seems.
That's right. And, you know, he came within a whisker of pushing Hamilton down to third, which would have only strengthened Verstappen's position in the championship even further. So, no, fair play. It was just surprising to me that he had the speed with which he closed on Lewis, because he came out about 9 seconds behind Lewis after his pit stop on lap 40, and he closed that gap up remarkably quickly, less than 20 laps. So, and then he had a good 10 laps, as I said, to have a crack at him, and never really came close. But still, I mean, a fair effort. And as you said, I mean, you mentioned him earlier, Pierre Gasly in the AlphaTauri. I mean, just absolutely nailed fourth place. Really strong race by him.
Yeah.
Completely in a class of his own between the top three and then the Ferraris.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Tsunoda wasn't there to compare against after lap one, but that whole weekend, Pierre was obviously superior to Tsunoda and really out driving what we'd expect from the AlphaTauri, you have to say. And to have that top five finish ahead of both Ferraris, ahead of both McLarens, yeah, really strong result.
Well, Honda won 3-4 in that last Mexican Grand Prix, so it just shows.
Here we go, promoting Honda again, Chris. Jeez.
Well, someone has to get in there before you. I mean, you know, they're going to be gone in four races. So I mean, it just what an amazing turnaround story, though, from where they were at the start when they re-entered the sport in the hybrid era to where they are now. Extraordinary turnaround. So you have to be, amazed at that ability to withstand that pressure and come good. Congratulations to Honda.
So, moving down the grid just a little bit, Ferrari, you know, really, really starting to get an edge on McLaren, it seems. They are now 13.5 points ahead of McLaren in the Constructors' Championship. Both Ferrari drivers have finished ahead of both McLaren drivers here at the Mexican Grand Prix. You know, it was a solid 18 points for the two of them combined versus, let's see if I can do the math, 1 point for McLaren. You know, it seems like they're really starting to have the edge here going into these last string of races.
Well, it looked, so again, Norris had a penalty, so that wasn't ideal for McLaren. So they're always on the back foot with Lando, but it looked like Daniel was going to be able to mix it with them. And unfortunately, he got a bit excitable in the first turn. So he ruined his race, and that just basically handed it to Ferrari. So big missed opportunity by McLaren to stay in the hunt for third. I think it's been so tight between them, it's hard to see them getting that initiative back. So really big weekend for Ferrari in the battle for third in the Constructors, for sure. We didn't talk about how tight the top has got, though. Just 1 point now between Mercedes and Red Bull in the Constructors' Championship. You know, Mercedes had 30, 40 points on them for a long time. And so that has got really interesting.
And 19 points Max Verstappen has over Hamilton now. So we're the best, you know, that is a second place and a fastest lap between Hamilton and Verstappen. That's the biggest gap we've seen all season, I think.
No, it was bigger before Silverstone. But yeah, it is at the sharp end of the season. It's a big old gap. And the reality is, if Hamilton doesn't outscore Max in Brazil, then he'll no longer have the championship in his own control. He will have to rely on some misfortune by Max or other people getting ahead of Max to be able to win the title. By that I mean, you know, let's say Max wins Brazil and Hamilton comes second, the gap will go beyond 25 points, so go to at least 26 points, right? So first and second place in the last three, the maximum Lewis could outscore Max, if they both came first and second, would be 21 points. So Lewis really needs to outscore Max.
Well, it'd be 24 if he could do fastest lap as well. Mm-hmm. And if he did well in the sprint race, that would negate that. But your general point is absolutely correct that his options are tightening way, way up really fast.
Yeah, that definitely. So, you know, Max, I think that was his ninth win this year out of 18 Grand Prix. So, you know, he has been the form driver, the dominant driver with the arguably the best car this season. He's been making the most of it. So, you know, it looks like it's coming to him. But I got a feeling there might be a twist or two left in this season.
Yeah. No, I'm with you there. Alpine, AlphaTauri, fifth and sixth, tied in the Constructors' Championship right now. That's a little spicy as well.
Yeah, it is. Especially, you know, Gasly's hugely strong performance in the race and Alpine's struggles. That would be pretty embarrassing for Alpine to slip back behind a second-string team into sixth position. Yeah, they don't want to do that, so they'll be fighting hard, I would imagine. But yeah, that's all to play for. And then, you know, Aston Martin, I guess, are probably out of it. But, you know, they had Vettel seventh was a strong weekend.
Yeah, agreed. And, you know, it was nice to see a little bit of life in Alfa Romeo. And it was nice to see Aston Martin still, still having some performance potential. But it hasn't been consistent enough. And that's why they're in seventh and in a position that's going to be really hard to improve from seventh. But also really hard to lose seventh as well. So I'm willing to gamble a little bit that seventh is going to be where Aston Martin Mercedes stays. We can say that on a happier note, that it looks more and more likely that Williams will be able to maintain eighth. Alfa Romeo does have some nicer form, but I don't think it's going to be nice enough to gather up 13 points or even 12 to tie it. So I think that Williams is starting to look pretty safe in eighth as well, which is a nice silver lining when you look at the last few years of Williams racing.
Yeah, it's funny you see it that way. I mean, I see Alfa Romeo. I thought the 23 points Williams had accumulated would absolutely guarantee them eighth place a couple of Grand Prix ago. But they haven't showed tremendous pace. They certainly weren't that quick in Mexico, because Russell was up in ninth place at one point. And then just drop down the order just through lack of pace. So, you know, Alfa Romeo are chipping away, and you could have, again, you know, if we have an odd wet race here or there, maybe in Brazil rather than in the Middle East, that could mix things up again. So I don't think it's done just yet, but I agree with you. It does look like it's Williams is to lose. But somehow they could still lose, I think.
Do you have any other final thoughts about Mexico? Because we do have something else to talk about. I want to get to my interview with Johnny O'Connell. And we have the Brazilian Grand Prix coming up in less than a week's time.
No, I think that'll just about do it. It wasn't the most exciting of Grand Prix. So let's hope the last four are a bit more spicy.
Well, then let me jump to my interview with Johnny O'Connell, because he had a lot of super interesting things to say. And it's going to be way more Formula One centric than you would ever guess. Here it is.
Well, it is a special treat and a delight for me to be able to say that I am sitting next to racing legend, hope you don't mind the term legend here, Johnny O'Connell. Johnny O'Connell is the winningest American at the 24 Hours of Le Mans and has tons of success in sports cars in a bunch of different categories. Johnny, how are you?
Doing great. Enjoying life. You know, people think I'm retired. I'm not. We'll call it semi-retired because I still want to get back to Le Mans and Sebring. Those places were always good to me, but grateful for the opportunities I got throughout my career.
Well, you'll notice I said legend, not retired legend.
Yeah,
so
I appreciate that.
And you had a lot of success with General Motors, Corvette in the past, and Cadillac more recently. You're still involved with General Motors now. What are you doing? How do you fill your days these days?
So right now I do a whole lot of coaching. So even when I was, you know, racing for GM, I was involved in, at that time, I was the vice president of the Bondurant School. Earlier in my career, I worked for Jim Russell and Skip Barber. So I've always enjoyed, you know, teaching and coaching. And so now I coach, you know, a bunch of drivers, some young kids that are hoping to have a career in motorsports, and a couple of older gentlemen that compete in Ferrari Challenge. And it's nice for me because it's very refreshing and rejuvenating to see the excitement that we all have when we just start to learn the sport and we start to get faster and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, and then with, you know, somebody like myself who's been doing it so long, you know, I know I can shortcut guys. I can, you know, what it took me 3 years to run, I can to learn, you can teach in a couple of days.
Right, right. So they don't have to make the same mistakes you did, kind of a thing.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, and it's also, you know, there's classic theory that is what is taught at all the driving school. Doesn't matter whether it's Spring Mountain or Radford or Skip Barber. Everybody teaches off the same playbook. But when you get to the upper levels, you know, guys break away from that. You know, and they kind of find different things that you can do to find speed. And so we give people shortcuts now and then.
Yeah, really nice. So we opened up by saying the winningest American at the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Let's break that down a little bit. How many victories are we talking about, and in what cars?
So four wins at Le Mans altogether. The first one with Nissan in 94. Then three with Corvette. I think it was 01, 02. Maybe my favorite was 09. That was with Garcia and Jan and myself. And the reason
being...
And that's
Jan Magnussen, Andy Garcia. Wait, no, that's
Antonio,
the actor.
Yeah.
Antonio Garcia.
Antonio Garcia. So two really, you know, great teammates, really, really fast guys. But that one, Jan got food poisoning at about 8 o'clock. You know, so you're only several hours into the race. And so he got food poisoning. So was Antonio and I going back and forth and back and forth the old days. So so that one was special. But
then,
yeah,
so that was the C5R and then the C6R in 09.
Correct. So yeah, no, always for some reason or another, very, very lucky. Always had good results there. You know, in the 15 times I got to do the race, which is only Mastin Gregory has more. But 9 times on the podium. So, and I got to tell you, if you want to talk about rocking chair equity, it's being up on that podium after a race and there's 150,000 people and they're screaming and waving flags. And, you know, of course, when, you know, being an American and racing for an American team, to have them play your national anthem over there, that's pretty wicked stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And, the 24 Hours of Le Mans podium, I've seen it. It's just an incredible, the atmosphere there. Yeah. And also, that means that you've participated in 15 of those day-before-the-race parades.
Correct.
That's a really special experience as well.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know about that, but there is a parade on Friday, the day before the race, that literally, and no lie, it's probably 200,000-300,000 people lining the streets of Le Mans. You're in these old antique cars. And slowly going through the crowd and, you know, signing autographs and meeting all the fans. And it was always fun when, you know, being teamed with Magnussen, because I swear half of Denmark shows up there. And so if you see a guy that's drunk and looks like a Viking, he's probably a Dane. And so that was always fun. I mean, there's just so much that's special about it. You know,
so why you're not a cultural educator in the U of M, in the American education system, I don't know, if you know good details like that.
Oh, yeah, you know what? Hey, you know what? I believe in being honest. You know, you're rarely going to get the politically correct answer from me. But the Danish people love me because I was Jan's teammate forever. So,
aside from that, sorry to interrupt, but you made me, you must have met and worked with Kevin Magnussen, Jan's son, several times, and he's in doing IMSA stuff now. What do you think?
It was really fun because when Jan and I were teammates at Panos, in 98, that was 98 through 2000. Yeah, Kevin actually came over to my house when he was a young kid.
Huh.
And so so I actually ran into him. I hadn't seen him in forever, and I ran into him at Laguna and reintroduced myself. He's like, I know who you are. You're my dad's teammate. I remember going over to your house. So and just a really neat, pleasant guy. But and a great example that so many. So I've like had 8 or 9 teammates that made it to Formula One. None of them think of it as the best time in their life or their career. I mean, if you're in Formula One and right now, if you're in a good car, it would be fun. But you know, Kevin never got a shot at a good car. Haas is just to me a laughing stock. They got rid of the wrong guy. They should have got rid of that Gunther guy. But I mean, so many of these guys, and same with Yann. I mean, super fast guys, but you got to have the equipment. You got to have the support in the team. But yeah, no. Getting back to Le Mans, you'd asked, you know, what categories. I raced the prototypes. You know, I was 3 or 4 times in the prototypes, and that was always with Panos. We didn't have the right, you know, equipment to win. But in 09, it was really interesting because we had won our class, and then Mika Salo had won the lower class, and so you know that was the year Peugeot won overall, and so you know they interview them first. And then after the winners, the Peugeot guys are done, literally half the press corps leaves. And so, you know, I'm about to talk, and Mika, who's just the best guy in the world, grabs a mic, and he's like, this is bullshit. Our win is every bit as valuable as the prototype's win. And he's right. And I've always made the argument that it's more difficult to win in the GT categories versus the prototype because you're having to look forward and backwards.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, if everything's in front of you, it's easy, you know. And so although they don't, you know, don't always get recognized that way. You know, when I watch Daytona, yeah, it's cool to see who wins overall. But I know those guys, whether they were in a Corvette, a Porsche, a BMW or whatever. OK, they worked harder. They had more challenges to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really fascinating because you talked about Formula One and the enjoyment. A great example of that was Juan Pablo Montoya. You know, I spoke with him a couple of times once he got in IMSA, and he was a much happier person at IMSA than he was at Formula One.
Yeah, you hear that all the time. You know, that these guys that made it in Formula One, they don't like it. Well, and it's, I think racing in America is a little bit nicer because everybody's not your enemy. You know, I think in Europe, you know, everybody's your enemy. You know, if you can find a way to screw a competitor, you do. And here I think it's a much nicer atmosphere where you can be buddies and associates. I mean, the number of, like, you watch the IndyCar guys. There are a lot of those guys that are really good friends, you know. And I don't think in Europe Formula One you have that so much.
So moving back to your career, you raced at Le Mans, but you did a lot of racing here in the States as well. I remember following you quite closely when you're doing Speed World Challenge stuff here in the States. What was your favorite form of motorsport of all the different things you participated in?
So I was a formula car guy. So when I, you know, I came out of go-karts, won a scholarship with the Jim Russell School, won their championship, you know, twice. Got into Formula Atlantics, won that championship, but I was the poor guy. And luckily, you know, Bobby Rahal and I went to the same university, and so I introduced myself to Bobby. And Bobby arranged for me to have a test with Jackie Stewart's team. And so, and at that test was Gilles DeFerrin, David Coulthard, and my buddy Mika Salo, and at Snetterton. And we were quickest. You know, I got back, and Bobby's excited, and Jackie's excited. And so we are contacting Budweiser. We're contacting R.J. Reynolds, you know, and Philip Morris. Tobacco sponsorships were really big back then. Couldn't get a dime because their attitude was that if they're going to spend money in Europe, they want to spend it on a European. They don't want to spend it on American.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, that's frustrating.
No lie.
Yeah.
And, you know what? There's not, you know, every country in the world is highly nationalistic except for the United States. So, like, if you're a French team, you want a French driver. If you're an Italian team, you want an Italian driver. You want an English team, then you want an English driver. And you're going to do all you can to get them. America, no. We're not that way. It's unfortunate. So at that time, I came back here. I was fortunate to get hired by Chip Ganassi in Indy Lights and race for him. You know, I think it was a 3 or 5 year deal with him. Did the first year, and they were paying me, which was nice. But at the end of
I mean, I'm with you. I like money too.
Money's they want a lot of money, man. I was still living like I was poor. I was pulling tires out of tire walls, you know, for my streetcar. But at the end of the year, the team manager's like, why are we paying Johnny when these European guys will pay us $500,000?
Yeah.
And so I was gone. And at that time, so one of the guys that I'd raced against a lot when I was younger was Tommy Kendall. And Tommy had gone the sports car route. And, you know, there's Tommy getting paid, you know, a really good factory wage.
Six figures?
Yeah.
And I interviewed him a couple years ago, and he was telling me the money was solid.
He was like, you know, you start out, I think he was like 150 grand or something, like in 1989, and I'm sure it went up from there. And I'm living in a garage.
Yeah.
So a guy that I raced Atlantics for got me a test with Nissan, did the test, was fastest at the test, but they didn't want a guy that was a fighting for a number one position with the team. Steve Millen was the number one. And so they hired somebody else, but they kept me in the rotation. And then finally, you know, I got to do some work for NPTI. And so that was me, you know, Jeff Bravo, Mari Leyendijk. And all of a sudden they compare this young kid to these fast, really experienced pros. This is from Jeff Brabham. I was going to get the IndyCar deal when Nissan was going to go IndyCar racing in 93, but the yen tanked and the president of Nissan had a heart attack, released him and replaced him with a guy that liked golf. And so luckily, I know it's like, Johnny, you sure you're Irish? Man, no Irishman should have that kind of luck. But you know, I was fortunate because they wanted me for the GTO car, and that was really what began my career. And then the best move, you know, again, I did some IndyCar and IRL. I don't want to say IndyCar, I'll say IRL, because it was just ovals when I did it, which I got to tell you, that was the first time I got into an IndyCar. You want your whole life, you're like, man, I want a shot at this. And it was at Disney World the first time I drove the car, and I'm going through the gearbox. And all I could think was, I can't believe I don't get to road race this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm like, because on the oval, back then it probably still is. If the car's right, it's easy. It's easy. You know, now.
There's plenty of inherent challenges in oval racing. Yeah. But it is, you know, you'll be flat all the way around the track. And it's just a matter of passing strategy. Yeah. And can you get more top speed out of the car by trimming it out?
By trimming it out. If it's right, it's easy. If it's not, you are like, I mean, when I did Indy in 96, every day, I'm like, today might be the day you're either going up to heaven or going to Methodist. I mean, our effort was that crappy. So anyway, you know, your career takes different turns and all that kind of stuff. I was very lucky, you know, I was actually pretty aggressive pursuing the ride at Panos. And so Don finally relented, put me in the car, went fast, you know, and then, you know, did my years at Panos. It was really good. But I could see Don pulling away from the racing, and he hired a new team manager every year. And so there was, you know, and it was always a Brit. And so, and I'm like, the last thing a Brit wants is an American. They want a British guy. And so I literally made a phone call. And I don't want to say it was in November of 2000 to Doug Feehan. Didn't really know him too well, but didn't get him. Got the voicemail. I'm like, Doug, you know, it's Johnny O'Connell. You might remember me from when I beat up on you in the Nissan. Nothing wrong with being cheeky. And I'm like, if your dance card isn't filled, you know, I'd love to talk to you. And literally 8 hours later, I had an offer. So the way everybody at Chevrolet and Corvette treated me. And it was just the world's greatest environment. And I want to say it was 41 times I got to win in the Corvette. I think only Gavin has more.
Wow.
And then they moved me over, you know, hey, man, you asked for the time I'm building a watch. But but you asked me about the World Challenge stuff. So then they moved me over to the Cadillac. And at that time, World Challenge was not a big deal. It was good, but you didn't get to do Le Mans. But sprint racing again with my own car that I didn't have to share, I loved it. And standing starts being the coolest thing ever in motorsport, you know, brought me back to my Atlantic days.
And in your era, there was getting to be some pretty stout manufacturer involvement.
It became that way. So in like, you know, in 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, those years, well, all of a sudden, factories, because I think maybe because I was there, they're like, well, we need to bring Patrick Long in. We need to bring Alvaro Parent in for McLaren. You know, and all of a sudden, you get a lot of fast, you know, you had 8 or 9 guys that could win a race on a weekend. And so that was really, really, really fun. And so I've got a lot of great memories there. We were very lucky there. So I won, you know, win the Corvette. I won, you know, I won 3 IMSA championships, really kind of 4, but you don't want to waste the time with that. And then
another interview. Yeah, we'll get into that.
And then 4 with Cadillac. And so, which should have been 5. But so we were lucky but we were good and we were pretty focused. So I think it was like 2016 and Jordan Taylor and I were talking and, you know, great guy. And we're talking about the series and it might've been a little bit later, but he's like, you know, in 2015, guys in IMSA wanted a race in World Challenge because IMSA wasn't what IMSA was. You know, it was a little, you know,
IMSA's kind of getting into a golden era now, but yeah. Back then it wasn't there yet.
And it was good. But then, you know, it became very obvious that with World Challenge that they didn't want Cadillac to win, and they've restructured everything. They don't, right now, they don't want a factory there. They don't want factory drivers there. They want wealthy gentleman drivers. And so I just think, you know, to me, again, everybody got their own personal opinion, but I think fans want to see gunfighters. I think they want to see the best, you know, in the world or in the country or whatever. And I think, you know, I hate that they got rid of standing starts. You know, I used to be, you know, I remember like being in mid Ohio and I wasn't even on the pole. I was like 6 or something. And I'm pulling in and I'm looking at the pit wall and, you know, Will Power's there, you know, Helio's out there. You got the IndyCar guys going out because they want to watch the start of the race.
Yeah, sure.
Now that right there is indicative of me that you've got something cool. But of course, you know what? They sold it to a European and, you know, it is what it is.
It is what it is. So you've had this career spanning decades. You've had a lot of success. What do you think about racing right now? What is your opinion of what you see in racing right now?
I mean, there's so many great things. I dig what's going on in Formula One. I think it's awesome. I mean, and it's not because I watched that Netflix thing. You know, it's because I've always been the guy to get
Drive to Survive, I think that's called.
But you know what? I'm glad that the ACO and IMSA are finally talking about, you know, getting a main category.
Right. And that's referring to the LMDH, which is the IMSA hybrid that's coming. Yeah. And then the LMH, which is the ACO Le Mans hybrid.
Well, the Europeans are always going to make it. I promise you this. They're going to make it so that the European cars are faster. You know, to win Le Mans. But, you know, I got to tell you, I love technology. Technology is great, but I hate technology in racing. So, like, literally, you know, you go back to the early 90s before you had traction controls, H-pattern gearbox, you didn't have ABS and all this kind of stuff. You knew who was good. You know, now with ABS, if you can't drive a race car with ABS, you're an idiot. You got paddle shifts, so nobody ever misses a gear. You know, it used to be that, you know, when you had a heel toe, okay, and manually change gears and all that kind of stuff, guys would make mistakes. But you know what? Mario Andretti wasn't making those mistakes. You know, you could see who the true greats are. So now, you know, I mean, it's nice for the gentleman driver, you know, because he's like, oh, man, I'm only 3/10 off of, you know, Dane Cameron or, you know, whoever the pro that weekend is. I just don't think I think a lot of times the racing right now is manufactured in a boardroom rather than on the racetrack. Hmm. You know, it used to be, you know, at the end of the year, you got a rule book. Everybody got the same rule book. Whoever interpreted that rule book better and changed the car would win races. Now, you know, back then, you know, you go to the IMSA races in the, you know, late 90s or early 90s and the American Le Mans series, they weren't doing BOP in American Le Mans series. You know, if Audi built the best car, Audi got to win.
Yeah.
You know, and so if Corvette built the best, Corvette got to win. You know, when ProDrive came in and they started going faster, here's a great story. So the very first 24 hours of Le Mans for Corvette was 2000, and they got beat by Viper. So they went back to France, and they're like, hey, listen, this is what we need in order to be competitive. You know, we need a bigger restrictor. We need this rear wing and all that kind of stuff. And the French were like, no. You need to make your car better. You need to make your car. What a novel idea. So what did Corvette do? They invested the money. They did wind tunnel, and they made the, you know, they made the car better. So, you know, now it's like, why build a great race car? So, like, if you're BMW and you build a $10 million race car, and it's awesome, it's badass, okay? And I come in and I'm like Johnny O'Connell Incorporated, but my car I only spent $5 million on. What the odds are pretty good they're going to be like, okay, we're going to give you a bigger restrictor. We're going to take weight off because we got to have the racing where it's, to me, that's stupid.
Yeah.
So anyway, so there's things I like about, I love what's going on in IndyCar. IndyCar's awesome again, you know, and you got a lot of great, young, talented guys coming up. I think IMSA is getting close to where it was in the ALMS days. Throughout my career, I still think the ALMS days were the best. Everybody ought to send hails to Don Panos because he saved sports car racing, I think, worldwide. And very much a if you build it, they will come type deal. But yeah. So, I mean, you know what? I didn't have money. I've literally, on my whole career, spent $15,000. So, you know, it is, well, no, if you add in go-karting, $25,000. I don't know whether that's possible anymore. If your dad's a billionaire, you got a famous last name, it's possible. But even the pit guy, you know, Ray Hall told me he was spending $150,000 a year on Graham to race go-karts. So,
yeah,
you know.
And that's kind of insane, isn't it?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
That's the Lewis Hamilton story.
Yeah.
You know, he came up, he was go-karting out of his dad's, out of his dad's trunk and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And Lewis Hamilton and his dad himself said, well, we don't think anyone can do it that way anymore.
Yeah. Well, and it's sad because, you know, my son wants to race, and he instructors for the AMG Academy. He's a great instructor. I think he's probably faster than me, but he's definitely better looking. But that's not saying a whole lot. But I'm like, dude, you give it to your 30. You know, maybe you come across that, you know, wealthy benefactor that will carry you. But it is unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Johnny, it's such a wealth of information. Last question for you. Favorite guy you ever raced against throughout your entire career? Who is that guy and why?
Oh, man. That's really difficult. You know, I've raced against some great guys. One of the guys I always liked was J.J. Lato. He was great. I got to meet so many cool guys. You know, I mean, Jan Magnussen is like a brother. A crazy brother. You know, I love Antonio Garcia, you know, Ron Fellows, you know, all great guys. There was never anybody I really liked in competing against because you can't like them. You got to kind of not like them, you know, at least the way my mental attitude was. Alvaro Parent, I really liked as a person. The guy I hated the most was Olivier Beretta.
That's the easier question, I guess.
Yeah, so on the racetrack, one of the nastiest, dirtiest guys in the world. Off the racetrack, one of the sweetest guys you're ever going to meet. Love Olivier Beretta, you know. He and I had a bunch of tussles back in the Corvette days. But if you ask me, like, you know, so Mario Andretti's my favorite driver by far. Just the greatest guy. I've gotten to hang out with him and nothing but respect for that guy. But, you know, right now, I got to tell you, I'm such a big Formula One fan. I love Lewis Hamilton. I love how that guy races. You know, he's, you know, in an era where guys will be dirty and chop and all that kind of stuff, he shows respect, in my mind, to his competitors. So big.
Did you watch, I think it was the Hungarian Grand Prix few races ago, and it was Hamilton and Alonso racing each other. That was some of the best racing I'd seen in years.
Yeah, respect. Respect. You know, you got to, you know, it's not just, okay, I'm here and now I'm coming down. You know, I mean, you got to work with a guy. And remember, you can get killed. Now, you know, that's one of the other things, you know. Cars and racetracks are so safe now that, you know, and you've got simulators. And so it's like, well, it worked in the simulator.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's, again, that's one of those ABS things. You get rid of ABS, I think there's a whole lot less wrecks. But yeah, no, big fan of Lewis. So, yeah, all good.
Yeah. Well, Johnny O'Connell, thank you so much for talking. It was great to chat, and really appreciate your time.
Anytime, my friend.
Yeah, so there it was. O'Connell was a big, big open wheel guy for a long, long time. Sports cars just kind of is where he could make a career. But his love, very much like my own, is single seaters.
And yet he never really had a chance to pursue a single seater career.
Certainly not. It didn't come to fruition like he had hoped. But I mean, listen, I think you can tell, you know, he's had a great racing career and still kind of doing a lot of racing activities now. Super fascinating guy to talk to, very direct in his words about the sport, and just refreshing to hear his opinions so clear like that. So it was a great conversation with him, and I hope you guys liked it. Now, we did take a week off between podcasts, that is true. But since we had our last show, I have put out 4 videos about cars. And that includes, I did the CT4V Blackwing. I have now also done the CT5V Blackwing. I also drove a new Polestar. So Polestar is the sub-brand of Volvo that are now, any new Polestar coming out these days is EV only. And that's what I drove, a Polestar EV only. I also drove a Porsche 718 Cayman GTS 4.0. That car is amazing. But the 4th video that I put out, sir, was... wait for it. Yes, the McLaren 720S. Oh my God, I had a supercar parked in my garage for a few days, and it was an incredible, incredible experience. Now, Chris, I know that you don't like any car coming to my driveway that costs more than $25,000, so I'm assuming you have no interest in hearing about this McLaren, but in case I'm wrong, let me know.
Yeah, you're right. If it's a compact car that costs more than $25,000, I'm not interested. If it's a supercar, well,
and
then
indeed, I am. McLaren is less than a compact car. It's only a 2-seater. It's even worse.
Yes. Well, as you well know, you were very kindly allowed me to visit you while you had that car. It is a sweet ride. There's no doubt about it, and it's a pretty cool video. So well done on that. It's it's something I'd like in my driveway on a more permanent basis.
Right. Well, I mean, just save your pennies and then steal some pennies and then get some friends to steal some pennies and then, you know, become a Russian oligarch. And I think that's all you got to do. I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah, the biggest challenge is which of my children I'm going to sell to fund the McLaren. It could end up being a coin toss, I think.
Well, you know, maybe Lawrence Stroll has an extra billion or two laying around. Maybe you sell it off to him and he starts another Formula One team.
Yeah, you could probably find the money, couldn't you? But it's just the depreciation. That's what would get me, Robin. Just knowing how much it would depreciate, but it is a fine old car.
There is irony in that, though, because the McLaren 720S has been out since the 2018 model year, which means, and it hasn't undergone any major changes from 2018. So you could be one of the people that picks up one of those depreciated cars and get it for pennies on the dollar, sir. And get much the same performance that you experienced in that 2021 model that we got to experience together. But, I mean, let's just get to the nuts and bolts of this thing. There was a lot of super cool engineering in that thing. And clearly you could just tell by the way that car was put together that it was an engineering-led operation. And you and I both being engineers by education, huge respect from my point of view. Honestly, and you seem to be smitten by it just as much, right? So a very, very cool car.
Very, very cool car indeed. Yep, it is. And the great thing is, ladies and gentlemen, it's not going to go rusty.
That's right. Whoa. You know, carbon fiber does not rust. There you go. And nor does aluminum or the plastics or all the other cool metals that it's made from. But I have to tell you, for less than a third of the price, that Porsche 718 Cayman GTS 4.0 is not bad, sir. That is a very, very nice car to drive. This is the 718 models. This is a mid-engine car, but the GTS has the 4-liter flat six, slightly detuned from the Cayman GT4. It makes 394 horsepower, 309 pound-feet of torque. It is just a fantastic sounding, beautifully revving, wonderful machine, that thing. And it's only $100,000 as optioned.
So I thought that was supposed to be the entry-level sports car for Porsche. So since when did that become six figures?
Well, this is the near top-of-the-line version of the entry-level sports car. So the base 718, I think it is the Cayman that's a little bit less than the Boxster. Those are right around $60,000. Okay.
Okay.
Now, the least expensive Porsche you can get is not the 718. That is the Porsche Macan. And that, I think a base Porsche Macan starts at right around $50,000. So.
Yes, but a Macan is an SUV, isn't it?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah, so why would you want that unless you
there's another way to think senses. Of it. If you, for whatever reason, find yourself in need of an SUV, why not get a Porsche SUV, which is really, really fun to drive, even though it's an SUV? However, yes, if you are in the position to have an SUV and something else, definitely go for the something else for your Porsche. I completely agree. But also, this CT5 V Cadillac, that is a retuned massage last generation Corvette Z06 engine in that thing. 668 horsepower in that car. 6.2 liter supercharged V8. Crazy, crazy quick. And unlike the M5s, unlike Audis, unlike Mercedes, in this mid-size level luxury sedan, that is still rear-wheel drive. That thing is an absolute blast. It is reminiscent of the E39 generation BMW M5. It is just glorious, glorious fun to drive.
Yeah, I can get behind a well-engineered sports sedan. Sports SUV, less so. But that Caddy did a great job with those two. High-performance black-wing cars, no doubt.
Yeah, and the CT4, 472 horsepower, certainly no slouch, but just the sound from that engine alone. And then, you know, I was in this big sedan on these not terribly straights in Pennsylvania, and I hit 138 miles an hour. And these things hustle. It's a spectacle. And the brakes held up really well. This is a two-ton performance sedan we're talking about, and the brakes held up really well. And the feel from the front end was really positive. You had a really good sense. It was good chassis balance. I mean, seriously, an absolute blast to drive. And this is definitely befitting the current flock of mid-size sedans from the German makes. So it was seriously impressive.
So would you take that Cadillac or the Escalade that you you tried out a few weeks ago?
Well, the Escalade have powered third row. I mean, how can you turn that down? No, of there course. I mean, the CT5 Blackwing was just absolute delight. I would take that double over. But of course, we're building up to the most exciting one of them all. That is the Polestar 2, and this was the single motor long range car, which means that it had a 78 kilowatt hour battery pack and a single 231 horsepower electric motor powering the front wheels. 270 miles of range, Chris Roche, from that electric vehicle, and it's got Swedish engineering. I mean, that's a slam dunk.
Yeah, Polestar's quite an interesting brand, actually. I'm quite familiar with it. I've done some studies on what they're up to. You know, it's an interesting sort of gestation of this company. It's sort of a spin-off from Volvo, which, of course, was owned by Geely. Volvo's just been listed, so it's now got a little bit more autonomy. It's not entirely owned by Geely anymore, but it is an interesting company. And as you said, it's got an EV future. But they're you know, they're sort of, the styling in particular is very cool. They've sort of taken all those cues that we know and love from Volvo, but made them sort of stylish, and it's kind of cool.
Yeah, and one particularly interesting bit about this car, it's the only one I've driven anyway, the Polestar 2 has what's called Android Automotive OS. It's basically a Google operating system. So this takes this whole, like, Android Auto, Apple CarPlay thing to the next level, and you have Google Maps and all those things natively built into the quote-unquote infotainment system of this car. So that is a genuine benefit. And Google voice recognition, that's been the new thing the last few years is, you know, hey, Mercedes, hey, BMW, hey, whomever, do this for me, do that for me. Well, the Polestar system with hey, Google is the best. It has been the most easy to use one that I've experienced. So that's a genuine just straight win for Polestar there that they have this system built into their cars.
I've always felt that was an interesting choice of name, though. It's got a certain 8 mile ring to it, don't you think, Polestar?
Well, you know, obviously, I'm sure you're aware that Polestar was originally, much like AMG, an independent builder of, like, you know, hot rodding up Volvos, and the name is decades old. So I don't know how old or what the origins are, but the name has history. Even if it maybe is a touch bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah.
But hey, whatever. We do have just a few days' time before we are watching cars lap Interlagos. But until then, I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcasts. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Oh, Chris, lovely afternoon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.